Welcome to another episode of the Enthusiastcast. I'm John. He's Mark. This is the show where we enthusiastically recommend a book we think that you should be reading. This week, I'm going to be talking about The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde by Junot Diaz.
John, what's up?
Not much. How about you?
Good. Your boy, Kevin Smith's in the news.
He's all over the news for something that shouldn't be news. He's fat. He's always been fat.
Okay. So have you listened to the Smodcast yet?
I have listened to the Smodcast.
Okay, so just give me a rundown of everything, because I've just been catching up with this over Twitter. And we'll get to the book reco in a second.
So for those who are unaware of what we're talking about, we're recording this on Monday, February the 15th. And this story broke, I guess, must have been late Saturday, February the 13th. And the deal is Kevin Smith, writer, director, sometimes actor, was flying home on a Southwest Airlines flight and was asked to leave the flight ostensibly because he posed a safety issue for the flight, which is their code for he was too big to fit, or they felt that he was too big to fit safely in the seat without impeding the ability of other people to get in and out of their adjoining seats. So he's a huge guy on Twitter, has a lot of followers on Twitter. So he immediately, as he's like taken back up to the sort of waiting area, he's sitting there while waiting for his next flight, and he's tweeting all about this, and it just blows up all over Twitter. The Southwest Twitter guy had to respond, and now there's a post responding to it on the Southwest blog. He also is a podcaster. He has a show called Smodcast, which he does normally with Scott Mosier, his longtime producer on his independent and Miramax films. And so Mosier is the M in Smodcast, not for Smith. But this one, so he gets home and immediately grabs his wife, Jennifer Schwalbach, who has done a couple of smods with him in the past. And she was just at hand. He actually was coming back from a recording of a live smod with his friend Malcolm, who is very famously the politically ignorant gay Canadian bear. Bear being a term in the gay community for sort of a large, burly, hairy man.
This is the longest intro ever.
Sorry, dude.
He was fat. He got kicked off a plane.
You got to know all this shit. You got to know that he flipped over live smodcast from a bear convention to talk about this shit. So
he fits the. He's big and hairy and fat. He could be a bear himself.
Absolutely. He went to where the love was. But
okay,
he gets home. He grabs his wife. He goes. He records a smodcast. Puts it up immediately, and it's basically him with occasional interjections from his wife, telling the whole story in laborious detail, even more laborious than that intro, of every single thing that happened from the point that he arrived at the airport to the point that he got home.
And is his wife consoling him or making fun of him?
No, she's totally on his side, because her take on it is that she is the agitator in the family, right? Like, if somebody is going to fucking blow up because of bad customer service or some shit that happens, it is going to be her. And he is always the conciliator who's like, no, don't say anything. Just let it go. You know, like, he's Mr. Manners. He's Mr. like non-confrontational. So for him to be agitated to the point that he is, you know, as he said, you know, just sort of like raising the earth with his fury is, you know, some shit has gone on.
Okay, so details about what it means to be a bear in the gay community aside.
Gotcha.
The facts of the case are what exactly?
The facts of the case, and I don't want his spot went on for an hour and a half, so I'm going to try to boil it down. Basically, he arrives at the airport.
Like, how do you get kicked off a flight and then go outside and wait for another flight? Like, if you're too fat, then why aren't you just like,
well,
you know,
the deal is the
loaded
policy,
onto a golf cart and like taken out to the cargo bay.
The Southwest policy is, and this is a policy at a lot of airlines apparently, is that if you're too large for a single seat, then you buy two seats. You pay for a second seat. Right. So now, first of all,
So he's a rich guy. Why didn't he just pony up for that?
Well, because he was flying standby and he really wanted to get home. So normally, and it so normally he does buy two seats, and they have pointed to this as, you know, he was aware of our policy. He normally buys two seats, and he's pointed to it and said, "I normally buy two seats because I don't want to have to talk to the person sitting beside me. So I buy two seats, and then I've always got that buffer zone between me and whoever else." Because Southwest is kind of like where he is, it's kind of a shuttle service. So these are Airbuses. There's no first class, there's no business class, nothing like that. So he's, you know, they're cheap seats, and he's in with the hoi polloi. And I guess his argument is, I'm kind of a shy person, and, you know, I don't want to get buttonholed by some overzealous fan, or even worse, somebody who fucking hates me and wants to spend my entire flight telling me how much of a fat douchebag they think I am. So he was supposed to be on like the 7 o'clock flight, or like 7:05 or something, whatever, that kind of time. And he had bought two tickets for that flight, but he gets to the airport early, back from Bearfest or whatever it was. And he's like, "Hey, you know, there's an earlier flight. It's around 5. Can I get on that?" And they're like, "Well, it's, you know, it's pretty full. And if everybody shows up, there's only going to be one seat left. But you're at the top of the list, you know?" And he's like, "Great." And at that time, the Southwest chick at the counter kind of makes the, "Are you sure?" And, you know, basically finds a way to mention, you know, "You were a person of size," which he eventually twigs to and is like, no, don't worry about it. I mean, I'm fat. I'm not, you know, let's call it what it is. I'm not in denial. I'm a fat man, but I'm not that fat. You know, like I fly these flights all the time. I can sit in the seat. I can put the armrest down. I can buckle the seatbelt without the extender, you know."
But she must have seen that he had two tickets booked on the later flight, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And so she's just like, "Oh, okay." So,
yeah.
Okay.
And she's seeing Kevin Smith, who, if you've seen Kevin Smith, and especially this last year, he's gained some weight. He's a big man. You know, he's not...
He looks jowly in the photo that I saw of him today.
Yeah. Well, obviously, they're choosing like the absolute worst pictures of him to put on the internet, but... Yeah, no.
No, it was a picture that he took of himself.
So. Oh, well, that was the one that where he blew out his cheeks or whatever, right? Because that's him on the later flight, and he takes that picture on his camera phone and he's like, "Look how fat I am, Southwest."
Okay, so let's unpack this. First of all, we need to state you love Kevin Smith.
Yes, I mean, I'm a ridiculous Kevin Smith fan. And actually, I'll tell you, it's interesting because I was trying to like think about this. It totally comes out of Smodcast. I mean, I'm a guy who'd seen his movies and thought they were funny and whatever, but my Kevin Smith love was kind of on the wane. And then I got into podcasts and he started doing Smodcast, and I was kind of in on the ground floor with that. And as a filmmaker and even as a writer, I feel like he's limited. He's got some skills, particularly as a writer, but I don't feel like he's a genius. For me, his genius is conversational comedy. Like, the Smodcasts are hysterical. Sometimes, you know, they're boring, particularly if it's the wrong guest. Like, when it's him and Scott Mosier, it's magic. Those guys are magic together. So the Evening with Kevin Smith videos that he does, where he goes around and he just does Q&A sessions all over the place, and he's recorded a couple of those, they're great. And Smodcast is great. And so that's the crux of my love.
Well, this brings up the question of whether or not this is just material.
Well, he deals with that in the Smodcast about this, because I guess the joke moment for him is they're taking him off the plane, right? Like, this girl, I can't remember her name. I think it was like Susie or something, is escorting him off the
4'3"
from
Houston.
Woman who, she doesn't come off that well. She does not come off that well in the Smod. But as he's getting off the plane, he locks eyes with this other dude who is on the plane, who is way bigger than him. And there's this moment where this dude is just petrified and he's like, "Don't give me up, man. I gotta get home." And, you know, and he's just like, "Well, I'm not gonna throw another fatty under the bus or the plane, as the case may be," you know. But he was just like, "They're coming for us. It's fat apocalypse. They're routing us up." And he's just like, you know, "Don't sell me out, man. Don't give me up." So he's at that point very much looking at it as, you know, yeah, I'm going to go nuclear. I'm going to raise a stink, but I'm going to be dining out on this story forever. This is going to be now part of my repertoire of stories, like fighting with John Peters about the Superman movies. And so the turnaround for him, though, is he ends up getting a later flight with two seats. The original flight that he was scheduled on to go home, when he's on that flight, so I guess they have groups of three seats, right? So it's him up against the window, his second extra fat guy seat beside him, and in the aisle seat, a large woman, young woman who's big, like his kind of size. And I guess the air hostess, or what do you call them now? Flight attendant.
We can call them stewardess. Stews.
The stew comes over and has a little conversation with this woman, and you know, takes her offside and has a conversation with her, and then she comes back to her seat. And then Kevin Smith and this woman, whose name he didn't get, they don't speak really for the whole flight. He's having a little nap or whatever, and then he wakes up and they have a brief conversation just before exiting the plane, and you know, he relates to her, you know, oh, I have been having a terrible day with this airline. You know, they kicked me off the other flight for being, you know, for being too fat. And he's like, ha, joking, you know, self-effacing, whatever. And this girl says, well, I had kind of an experience at the beginning of this flight where this flight attendant took me aside and said, like, listen, you know, you might want to consider in future buying two tickets.
Okay.
So
that's,
like,
that's too rich.
I know.
So let's go back to the beginning. First of all, there's like there's the whole like fat politics thing of this, right?
Right.
And like,
and they very, when they were talking to him, they were very careful not to use the word fat, and he kept trying to get them to say fat, not to buttonhole them so that he could sue them, but just like, let's call it what it is. I'm too fat. You think that I'm too fat to fly on this plane?
Right. And like, you know, whatever. That is like a big thing in a big thing. That's a big thing in the U.S., right? Like,
it's a big problem.
Yeah, well, the obesity is a problem. Child obesity is a problem. But like, fat discrimination is now a legitimate kind of deal, right?
And, yeah.
And so when people hear, especially people that might like not have the best body image or whatever, hear that someone's being discriminated against for being a little overweight, then, you know, the whole conversation just shifts to a new level of crazy.
Well, and the airline is – it's a really weird space right now, because the airline is one of these few areas where being overweight butts up in a negative way against commerce, because obviously it's in the interest of the airline to have seats that are – as small as possible, so that they can fit as many people as they can on the plane.
And there's a weight issue, and then there's also the safety concern, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and then secondly, there's this idea of celebrity customer service, right? So, like, he's got, whatever, 1.6 million followers, and him complaining to those followers is kind of a new phenomenon, right?
The fact that he was blowing this shit up within the 8-minute space that it took for them to come over and talk to him after taking him off the plane.
Right. And because he's famous, I really think there's a question of when that's appropriate and when it's not, right? Like,
right.
There was an issue of the Calgary Flames getting special treatment when the swine flu injection came around to Calgary, right? All these people were lined up, and here come the Calgary Flames in their Range Rovers, and they just skip the line because they're the Calgary Flames. So this idea of like famous people getting special treatment is like a whole other kind of issue. Then there's the social media aspect of it, and I find this really interesting in comparison to Kevin Smith's last customer service problem with Sears Canada, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's really kind of fascinating how Southwest has responded and how this has gone on and how we're now talking about it on a podcast, I guess.
So you maybe know more about the Southwest response than I do. I've read the letter that they've got on their website, and they were apparently supposed to call him, but I haven't seen anything reported about that call actually happening. And I know that he's been tweeting about this, but I don't see his tweets. So
right, and then the last thing is what actually happened, and like what are the facts of the case, right? So like, did he, you know, has he been buying two seats all this time? And like, I guess the Southwest policy is quite common, and it's like quite old, and like, you know, like, was he discriminated against on the spot, or was it like, you know, how did things actually happen? So the to answer your question about the social media part of it and the response, they called the phone number that he gave at check-in, at booking, which wasn't his cell phone, or wasn't the phone number in which he could be reached. So,
right.
So I think that there since has been, because there was several attempts on their part to be like, okay, guy, like, send us your phone number, right? And we will call you in the aftermath. So I don't know. That's kind of the last I saw it. They tried. They couldn't get through to him. They then went back to him on Twitter and were just like, you know, direct message your phone number to us so we can contact you. So, but that was 2 days ago. So, so fat politics, yeah, okay. Like, that's...
Well, this is where he ends up at the end of the Smodcast, is that his two arguments are, you know, yes, I am fat. Yes, I understand that somebody could be so fat that it is reasonable to ask them to buy two seats. And if two seats are not available, to not allow them to fly on the plane. But I am not that fat. So
my two seat thing
was
probably
not
misinterpreted, but isn't, because
it's not some tacit endorsement of your policy.
Right.
I buy two seats because I can, because they're cheap as dirt and I have money, and I like the extra space because it's a buffer. So, you know, his argument is that they acted incorrectly by the terms of their own policy, and that they handled it badly. And then, you know, even once they had made the decision to enact this policy with regards to him, that they handled it badly, that the customer service that he received, you know, from them in this scenario was poor. And then with the sort of the added experience of what happened to the woman on the second flight that he was on, he kind of took it to the level of, this is like, there is institutional discrimination happening now. You know, my impression, my opinion is, my being Kevin Smith, that there's institutional discrimination happening against fat people, where they're not being treated like human beings. That people, that under the auspices of this policy, people feel people at Southwest, maybe people at other airlines, I don't know, they feel empowered to do and say things that they normally would never do and say.
So, apology aside, he's still pissed off.
Oh, he is pissed off. He's like scorched earth. They can apologize from now until the end of time. I don't care. I'm, you know, he wants them to change their policy now. That's his thing.
Okay. So what do you think about it then? Like, do you think that, because I heard that this policy is like kind of standard and kind of old, so should, it's not the policy itself, it's the application of the policy, no?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The policy apparently has been around for 25 years. Long time. And I'm a guy who's worked for big companies a long time, and I kind of understand, you know, companies that, well, as any company does, deal with a lot of customer service, or at least deal with the public. And so I understand how one bad decision by one person can get blown out of proportion. And, you know, it sort of propagates across all media. And in this day and age, that is all media everywhere instantaneously. So I have a certain amount of sympathy for Southwest in this arena. But at the same time, it sounds like, to hear him tell it, they humiliated him unnecessarily. And they humiliated this girl, on the second flight, unnecessarily. Like, they dealt her they dealt her a blow that, you know, to her self-esteem. I mean, I have a friend, a female friend, who a little bit larger and, you know, once was offered a seat on a bus by somebody who thought that she was pregnant when she wasn't pregnant. She's still scarred by that, like, you know, 15 years later. So I can absolutely see that point, that this is an arena where the utmost delicacy must be observed, because the consequences for the individual that you're dealing with are so potentially damaging.
So in those terms, in that frame of reference, you see him doing the good thing by taking to Twitter.
I think that if the net result of this is that those situations, and like that is, as I said before, it's a legitimate thing. If somebody is too big for their seat, then if those situations are handled with more sensitivity in the future because of this, I think that's a good thing. What I think they should have is, to relate another anecdote, years ago, I went to an amusement park with a person who's quite large, and there was a moment where it didn't look like the overhead seatbelt was going to be able to come down far enough to lock, and it was just one of those moments where absolutely that person can't ride the roller coaster if they're not safe, if their seatbelt hasn't locked, why would they want to? But, you know, there's tons of people lined up watching this all transpire. It's not a fun moment for that person. And they could have been spared that. I went to an amusement park recently, and what they have now is like a sample seat right, you know, way at the outskirts of where you enter into the ride, where you can sit down and test to make sure that the harness is going to fit you properly. So if you are a person of size and, you know, this test seat doesn't work for you, you don't put yourself in that scenario, right? You don't get in that line. You don't go on that ride. It's a win for everybody. You still have your dignity and, you know, they don't run any liability or whatever by letting you on the ride or not letting you on the ride. So I think they should have something. This policy has been in place for 25 years. Why not have something like that for airlines? You know, sit in this seat, and if you meet these standards, you're good to go. And if you don't, you need to buy an extra seat. And then you can make that determination for yourself with your dignity intact, and it's a win for everybody. I mean, I don't think when I look into the mind or try to put myself into the mind of the person who's got to come over and enact that policy, this isn't like a win for Southwest. There's no upside to Southwest chucking a person, Kevin Smith, Twitter superstar or not, off a plane. That's a lose for Southwest. They don't want to be in that position. So obviously, it's only the fact that they think that the potential consequences are that much greater that they're willing to do it in the first place.
It's interesting because Seth Godin has got a new book out. It came out the same day as the iPad, interestingly enough. So he's got an MBA in marketing and was doing his best to kind of outdo the iPad.
Right.
And so what the book is about is about how doing service work is hard.
That's
not what it's only about, but he's just like, listen, you know, we are now in a knowledge economy where we add value to information, and that needs to be taken seriously and professionally, in a way that he feels most people don't, right? And so what the example that he was citing over and over again in pre-publication was this idea of stewardess and flight attendants on planes, in that they have to go to work every day, and they have to be nice, and they have to be nice professionally in a way that's not fake, that's sincere, that's adaptable, and all these good traits,
yeah,
and still not be a robot, right? And so he kind of zeroes in on that intersection in the book, and I haven't bought it and I haven't read it, but I think it takes up a chapter or two in there. So
it's like the problem of enforced sincerity.
Right. Right.
And he's
a much better communicator than I am, and seemingly you're a much better person at summarizing my lack of communication skills.
But have we covered that one?
I think so.
Do you agree with all of that?
It's interesting from a social media perspective, I find, because I think that they did a good job of handling it over the air. And no company knows how to do this, so we're just kind of making it up as it happens, right? So we've never had a star with 1.6 million people listening to him all at once with a megaphone in a customer service situation. And vice versa, you've never been like the customer service representative dealing with that person once scorned, right? And so, yes. So just kind of, I'm not watching closely, but I picked up the story on Twitter and ducked over and saw the response on the blog and was just like, wow, you know, like they have a blog, unlike many other companies that would be caught out in that situation, right? And not be able to respond. And I referenced earlier how he was upset about the Wayne Gretzky jerseys. And that was never, to my knowledge anyway, dealt with publicly, right? So there's a big question mark in my mind and in his fan, in every one of his fans' minds. About the resolution of that problem until, of course, he brings it up, right? So the power's all in his hands. Which is just new and trivial, and that's just an area that I'm interested in, so that's pretty much all I have to say about it. So.
Well, this is interesting in another way, and actually a way that plays into the book I want to talk about, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, in that I first heard about this on entertainmentweekly.com, where it was just reported just as a news bite, and then flipped over and saw had read a couple of his tweets about it, flipped over and saw the Southwest response, thought that it was a good response, and was impressed at the speed of their response, that they were responding basically on the weekend to something that happened on the weekend, which is a kind of corporate speed that you sometimes don't see. My other first thought was, well, he's got a movie coming out, and so is this kind of a publicity stunt? Like, I'm sure it happened, but is he jumping off on this as a way of raising his public profile a little bit right before the movie's released? And then downloaded the SMOD and listened to that. And at the end of the SMOD was pretty much fully back in his court going, you know, my God, discrimination against fat people is, the plague of the 21st century. We must unite. And all joking aside, it was interesting to get a perspective. I'm a skinny dude who's been skinny his whole life. I don't have any personal insight to what that must be like. And so it was good from a pure empathy standpoint to have him, who's a fantastic storyteller, put me in those shoes and make me see the world that
so
way.
What does this have to do with your endorsement?
Well, because The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao is about a lot of things, but one of the things that it is about is the tyranny of the narrative and how when you are being told a story, when you're reading a book, regardless of how many voices it appears to speak in, regardless of how many points of view it appears to include, it's really just one person talking. And in that way, it's like a dictator, and that's a very purposeful thing that the author Junot Diaz does in the book, because one of the big background figures in the book is Rafael Trujillo, who was the dictator of the Dominican Republic from, I have it here, 1930 to 1961.
Interesting. Okay.
So back it up.
All I know about this book is it was a rage last Christmas. Kind of people on their holiday vacations were kind of reading this all over Hawaii, and that was because it was endorsed somewhere on like the Today Show or on Oprah or wherever, and it just kind of exploded all at once. How did you hear about this?
I heard about it through the comics connection, actually. So to back it up, this book. It's The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, written by a guy named Juno Diaz. This is his only novel to date. He had an earlier collection called Drown, which is a collection of short stories. It was published in 2007, won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 2008.
That's where it blew up. Okay.
Yeah, and I think that's why you should read it, because the year before it was The Road by Cormac McCarthy that won the Pulitzer Prize. So they're on some kind of roll over there. Because, you know, normally the Pulitzer winners are just crap. But it makes me actually want to read Olive Kitteridge by Elizabeth Strout, which is the Pulitzer winner the year after this, because I'm just like, I love The Road. I love this. So hopefully that's in the same ballpark. It's also interesting that the Pulitzer winner in 2000 was The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon, which is a book heavily influenced by comic books. It's about two comic book creators, and it's kind of a pastiche history of the golden age of comics and comics, Jewish comics creators particularly. And prior to this book, that was the book that comics nerds had read, right? Like the stereotype, and it is not without some truth to it, is that, you know, comics geeks just read comic books. And this was like that one book that, you know, comics guys would break out on message boards and say, no, I read regular books. I've read The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which of course is all about comic book creators. And so now this is kind of that book, because it is steeped. It's like, I like to think of this book as trilingual. It's written in English, Spanish, and nerd, because there are heavy references in this book to nerd stuff, nerd culture, references that I couldn't believe. Like the epigraph to this book is, let me just get it here. Of what import are brief, nameless lives to Galactus? That's the epigraph. It's a quote from Fantastic Four 49 from 1966. And, you know, you had me at Galactus. Like,
okay, so comics connection. Okay, that makes more sense. I was just reading a review this past weekend of a new book called The Amazing Absorbing Boy by Rabindranath Maharaj, who is a Canadian writer, but also from the islands.
Okay.
And it referenced the Diaz book because The Amazing Adventures of Absorbing Boy is got heavy comic book influence. So
I will say that the comic book references in this are they inform the language in it. To give you kind of an overview, it's not a plot heavy book, and the title is actually kind of misleading in that Oscar, first of all, his name's not Oscar Wow. The Oscar Wow is a nickname that he gets in story he quotes Oscar Wilde. And so Oscar Wow becomes something that he's referred to kind of disparagingly as by some other characters in the book. So his last name is actually De Leon, and it's a family story. So it's him, it's his sister Lola, it's his mother Belly, and his grandfather Abelard. And that, so it goes right back to, and it covers 1944 to 1995. So it goes right back to sort of the heart of the Trujillo era in the Dominican Republic. And then it looks, that's one aspect of it. It's how the sort of the shadow of Trujillo cast a pall over his whole family's life. And for those who don't know, I don't know a lot, but Trujillo was this, this dictator. Sometimes publicly he was the head of the government, and then other times he was sort of the shadowy guy in the background, a military leader who was running things, although not publicly running things. And he was a cult of personality, just an incredibly charismatic figure who, you know, renamed everything after himself. Basically, you know, half of the Dominican Republic is still named, still has, like, Alexander the Great. It still has names that are based on his name. And although it was an incredibly violent time, there was no opposition to his rule, but he also basically ushered the Dominican Republic into the 20th century and built the infrastructure and the economy. And so it posits that, and then in a meta way, in a postmodern way, it looks at sort of the dictatorship of authorial voice. And so the story, it flips around in time. There is one narrator, but at the same time, the narration is in first, second, and third person, depending on the point of view. And then also the language used by the authorial voice is, it's all over the place. It's literary. It uses a lot of urban rhythms and urban slang. There, like I said, there's tons of references to not just comic books, but anime and science fiction and The Lord of the Rings and, you know, as they're called, the genres, just nerd stuff galore. And then there's a ton of Spanish in the book. And apparently there's, I'm not a Spanish speaker at all. But apparently there's three different kinds of Spanish in the book. You know, there's the older Spanish, Spanish in the Dominican Republic, the sort of Spanglish that evolves in New York after the diaspora of the Dominican people, like away from Trujillo. So there's all of these narrative elements about that are designed to undercut the authority of the voice and remind you that you're reading something that was written to convince you of something, and maybe you shouldn't be convinced of that, and maybe you should question that. So
where's the mom in this? Because I thought that this was appealing to kind of the book club crowd, but the plot that you just described to me doesn't sound like it's accessible to the middle-aged moms.
Oh no, there's like I say, the character of Oscar, and Oscar's the heavy nerd in this. Heavy in the sense that he is also, like, the character of Oscar is a tragic figure. This ties into Kevin Smith as well. He's hugely overweight and unsuccessful with women to the nth degree. And so he is, you know, he is the proto-nerd, and it also, you know, cuts that against the traditional image of Dominican masculinity, which is a hyper-masculine, hyper-sexual, and hyper-sexually successful male figure. That's the classic, you know, I'm getting all of this from the book. Prior to this, I didn't have an image in my mind of what a Dominican man was like, but apparently within the Dominican culture, you know, as he puts it in the book, the narrator, you know, the Dominican man has atomic level G. He is just, you know, he's the Mac. And Oscar is not that at all. He is a completely at the other end of the spectrum, but he's not in the book that much. It goes fairly quickly from Oscar to Lola, who is his sister, who is, again, very different from Oscar. She's very beautiful, very self-possessed. And then it goes back further, and there's a very large section which is about his mother and her life in the Dominican Republic before she came to New York and all of the things that, you know, impacted and affected her. So the woman's story in this, and not that, you know, all stories that appeal to women, the middle-aged women, have to be women's stories, but in this particular instance, the female point of view, the mother's point of view, the woman's point of view, is huge, huge. So I can absolutely see why the Oprah Book Club was like, you know, I don't know if this was an Oprah Book Club pick, but, you know, it totally could be, and it would be beloved.
Right. Got it. That's cool. That's a great endorsement. So it took you a while to finish. What's the page count?
The page count is 300 and some, 335.
Oh, okay.
335.
So that's not crazy.
There we go.
But, cool. Do you want to say anything else, or do you just want to wrap it up?
Well, you know what? I actually, because the voice is such an important part of this, I actually wanted to read like a little piece out of it and just give you a sense of what you're getting when you sign on for this book.
Let's go.
All right. All hope was gone, but then true believers, like the hand of the ancestors themselves, a miracle. Just as our girl was set to disappear across that event horizon, just as the cold of obliteration was stealing up her legs, she found in herself one last reservoir of strength, her Cabral Magus. And all she had to do was realize that once again she'd been tricked, Once again, she'd been played by the gangster, by Santo Domingo, by her own dumb needs to ignite it. Like Superman in Dark Knight Returns, who drained from an entire jungle the photonic energy he needed to survive Coldbringer, so did our Belly resolve out of her anger her own survival. In other words, her coraje saved her life.
Nice, nice. So you you worked on some Spanish pronunciations?
God only knows if I did that well.
Throughout the book, you were like,
I just looked up the Spanish words to make sure that what I was saying was not horribly profane and offensive, because there's a lot of that. I will say also, and we're going to put this in the show notes on the blog, that there is a link to like a video podcast that was a speaking engagement that Juno Diaz did, which I think everybody should check out if they've read the book and they enjoyed it. And also there is a website, which is the annotated Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, which gives you links and explanations for not only all of the nerd stuff in the book, but all of the Spanish in the book as well. So,
whoa, so does that have the book text as well, or just the...
No. Just the, it breaks it down by like page, chapter, and reference. So
that is brilliant, though. Annotated website, and it's not by the publisher, I bet.
No, it's totally fan.
Oh, that's so good. That's so good, man. Oh, we just need more publishers to like think in those terms. Anyway, we're at 45 minutes ish. So let's cut you off, because my enthusiasm for your enthusiasm is kind of. I'm picking up what you're putting down. I'm liking that stuff. So we hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on the aforementioned website, enthusiasticcast.com, for show notes and links to more details about everything we've talked about this episode. Check the blog for our next showtime, or simply hang tight for an update in your RSS feed if you choose to follow us that way. Until then, I'm Mark.
I'm John.
And cheers. Thanks for listening.